This is the Literary License Podcast, Classic Novel Episode. Dealing with classics you must read before you die, and finding new life in between the dusty covers. Exploring page to screen and everything in between with your co-hosts, Jesse Foots, Vicky Ray, Leandro Getzi, and Keith Chalgo, who ensure to bring the fun to an old standard.
Hello, welcome to Literary License Podcast, and today we're discussing Little Women by Louise May Alcott and the 1933 film Little Women starring Katharine Hepburn. And before we get started, let's find out who's with us. First, we have Vicky Ray with us. Hello, Vicky.
Hi, everybody.
And Leandro Getzi. Hello, Leandro.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm groovy. And before we get started, let's find out what we've been up to. Starting with Leandro, what have you been up to since last month?
Yeah, he's got a chance to say what he's been up to.
I'm working now, like, every day, like, before all the lockdowns. I have finished to sow everything in the allotment that I have, so I'm not having eating few vegetables that are ready now. And I started to go back to the gym, so back on track.
Gyms, yes.
And what about yourself, Vix? What have you been up to?
Not much. I've been talking to you more than I need to. No, we've been busy with you and doing those couple of interviews for our little project. Just watching my typical horror stuff, trying to guess what Joe Bob's doing for tonight on the drive-in. Just getting ready for a couple of state races for Asher. And other than that, I'm getting a roof on right now because of storm damage. Hopefully they won't be pounding too hard where my microphone's going to pick it up. But not a whole lot since I seen y'all last.
Let's see, myself, I watched the Kominsky Method on Netflix.
Yeah. I forgot to look that up last night. I totally forgot.
That's very, very good. And then other than that, haven't done a lot really. Been doing interviews for the show for season 5. And that's been really fun and interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, just carrying on with life. So that's about it, really.
That's right. Just keep on keeping on. That's what all of us are doing. So.
So this brings us to talking about Little Women, which is a coming-of-age novel written by the American novelist Louisa May Alcott, which was originally published in 2 volumes in 1868 and 1869. Alcott wrote the book over several months at the request of her publisher. The story follows the lives of the 4 March sisters, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, and details their passage from childhood to womanhood. Is loosely based on the lives of the author and her 3 sisters. Scholars classify it as an autobiographical or semi-autobiographical novel. Little Women was immediately commercial and a critical success, with readers demanding to know more about the characters. Alcott quickly completed a 2nd volume titled Good Wives in the United Kingdom, although the name originated from the publishers and not from Alcott. And it was also successful. The 2 volumes were issued in 1880 as a single novel titled Little Women, which is what we're covering as both volumes of that. Alcott wrote 2 sequels to her popular work, both of which will also feature the March sisters, Little Men from 1871 and Joe's Boys from 1886. The novel addresses 3 major themes: domesticity, work, and true love, all of them interdependent and each necessary to the achievement of a heroine's individual identity. According to Sarah Elbert, Alcott created a new form of literature, one that took elements from romantic children's fiction and combined it with others with sentimental novels, resulting in a totally new format. Albert argues that within Little Women can be found the first version of the all-American girl, and that her various aspects are embodied in the differencing of the March sisters. The book has been translated to numerous languages and frequently adapted for stage and screen. So what we're going to do is cut to the synopsis, and we'll be right back. This is the synopsis for Little Women by Louisa May Alcott.
Louisa May Alcott prefaces Little Women with an excerpt from John Bunyan's 17th century work, The Pilgrim's Progress, an allegorical novel about leading a Christian life. Alcott's story begins with the four March girls, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, sitting in their living room, lamenting over their poverty. The girls decide that they will each buy themselves a present in order to brighten their Christmas. Soon, however, they change their minds and decide that instead of buying presents for themselves, they will buy presents for their mother, Marmee. Marmee comes home with a letter from Mr. March, the girl's father, who's serving as a Union chaplain in the Civil War. The letter inspires the girls to bear their burdens more cheerfully and not to complain about their poverty. On Christmas morning, the girls wake up to find books, probably copies of The Pilgrim's Progress, under their pillows. Later that day, Marmee encourages them to give away their breakfast to a poor family, the Hummels. Their elderly neighbor, Mr. Lawrence, whom the girls have never met, rewards the charitable activities by sending over a feast. Soon, Meg and Joe are invited to attend a New Year's party at the home of Meg's wealthy friend, Sally Gardner. At the party, Joe retreats to an alcove and there meets Lori, the boy who lives with Mr. Lawrence. While dancing, Meg sprains her ankle, Lori escorts the sisters home, and the Marches regret having to return to their daily routine after the holiday festivities. Joe visits Lori when he is sick and meets his grandfather, Mr. Lawrence. She inadvertently insults a painting of Mr. Lawrence in front of the man himself. Luckily, Lori's grandfather admires Joe's spunk, and they become friends. Soon, Mr. Lawrence meets all the sisters, and Beth becomes his special favorite. Mr. Lawrence gives her his deceased granddaughter's piano. The girls have various adventures. Amy is caught trading lines at school, and the teacher hits her as a punishment. As a result, Mrs. March withdraws her daughter from school. Joe refuses to let Amy go with her to the theater. In retaliation, Amy burns Joe's manuscript, and Joe, in her anger, nearly lets Amy drown while ice skating. Pretty Meg attends her friend Annie Muffet's party, and after allowing the other girls to dress her up in high style, learns that appearances are not everything. While at the party, she hears that people think she intends to marry Lori for his money. That year, the Marches form the Pickwick Club, in which they write a family newspaper. In the spring, Joe smuggles Lori into one of the club meetings, and he becomes a member, presenting his new circle with a postbox. At the beginning of June, the Marches decide to neglect their housework. At the end of a lazy week, Marmee takes a day off, too. The girls spoil a dinner, but everybody ends up laughing over it. One day, Lori has an English friend over, and the Marches go on a picnic with them. Later, Joe gets his story published for the first time. One dark day, the family receives a telegram saying that Mr. March is sick in the hospital in Washington, D.C. Marmee goes to tend to him, and Joe sells her hair to help finance the trip. Chaos ensues in Marmee's wake, but the girls neglect the chores again. Only Beth goes to visit the Hummels, and after one of her visits, she contracts scarlet fever from the Hummel baby. Beth teeters on the brink of death until Marmee returns. Meanwhile, Amy spends time at Aunt Marcia's house in order to escape the disease. Beth recovers, though not completely, and Mr. Brooke, Lori's tutor, falls in love with Meg, much to Joe's dismay. Mr. Brooke and Meg are engaged by the end of part one. 3 years have passed, and before part two begins, Mr. March is home from the war, and Lori is nearly done with school. Soon, Meg marries and moves into a new house with Mr. Brooke. One day, Amy decides to have a lunch for her art school classmates, but poor weather ruins the festivities. Joe gets a novel published, but she must cut it down in order to please her publishers. Meanwhile, Meg struggles with the duties of keeping house, and she soon gives birth to twins, Demi and Daisy. Amy gets to go to Paris instead of Joe, who's courted on her trip. Because their Aunt Carol prefers Amy's ladylike behavior as a companion. Joe begins to think that Beth loves Lori. In order to escape Lori's affections for her, Joe moves to New York so as to give Beth a chance to win his affections. There, Joe meets Professor Bauer, a poor German language instructor. Professor Bauer discourages Joe from writing sensationalist stories, and she takes his advice and finds a simpler writing style. When Joe returns home, Lori proposes to her, but she turns him down. Beth soon dies. Amy and Lori reunite in France, and they fall in love. They marry and return home. Joe begins to hope that Professor Bauer will come for her. He does, and they marry a year later. Amy and Lori have a daughter named Beth, who is sickly. Joe inherits Plumfield, Aunt March's house, and decides to turn it into a boarding school for boys. The novel ends with the family happily gathered together, each sister thankful for her blessings and for each other. And that is his synopsis for Little Women.
Hello, welcome back to Literary License Podcast, and we're discussing the novel Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. So, Leandro, what are your thoughts of Little Women?
Well, be honest. It's definitely a book that I will read, you know, like, if I have to go to the library and choose something. I was a bit familiar about this story because when I was a kid, my sister used to, well, it was me and my sister because, you know, those days you couldn't choose what you were watching. It was just one person who can choose, and she used to watch a cartoon, so I have more or less an idea. I couldn't remember the story, and when I read the story, I came like back. I don't know how to play like play. I enjoy it, but I wouldn't like read it like. Was a fair
it's a
choice.
Girl book. It's a girl book.
Yeah, I like one part that there was the neighbor doing something great for one of them, and you know, and everyone was like trying to help her, and that really like it in one part seems to be really like superficial, and yeah, I don't know.
Superficial.
What about yourself, Vic? What are your initial thoughts?
Down with the patriarchy. No. it was about women struggling, basically, in what, Civil War times, right?
Yeah, at the end of the Civil War, yeah.
And it was, they had family duty, or they could grow personally, which was kind of hard. You had like two girls. Two? It was Meg and Amy. Well, they were the ones that were kind of vain, weren't they? They were kind of materialistic. Beth, I didn't know what to think about her because she was just like a martyr, basically. She was going to do everything familial duty that she could do. And I guess it was four different ways of women to be productive in that time frame, which, and you know, at the same time, women were starting to bust out of this, you know, I don't know, the dark period where they were property or couldn't own property or couldn't do this. And they had a lot of emphasis on domestic duty and family kind of detracted from certain things. But Jo wanted to be an author, and she was also a tomboy, which was frowned upon back then. But they all tried to fit in some way. And I think towards Little Wives, it was called, the two books were joined. And you have all this growth and all this sort of like rebel, you know, stuff going on where these women are just trying to find their niche in life for the most part. And they're trying to find how they're going to fit into this world because, like I said, women's roles were kind of changing at this time. They weren't great, but, you know, they were getting there. And when you got to the little wives, they seemed to have lost their luster for growth and for achieving as much, and they kind of settled into the practical wife thing, you know, that was of that century. So it just depends. I mean, it was an enjoyable book. I mean, it showed struggles and personal triumphs and stuff. So it had a little bit of everything, but it was a time frame book, and it was really more written for women, I would think. I can't see Leandro going out and buying five copies of it.
Well, I have to sit there and say, what it kind of reminds me of is a TV series, like Little House on the Prairie or The Walton.
Yes, exactly.
Where every chapter was like an episode, mm-hmm. but there's never really anything really connecting. So you kind of like, you know, you got like, you know, Amy struggle at school because of the pickled limes. And then
do you think that was because she kind of got forced into writing this book and her heart really wasn't into it, or?
Well, no, the thing is, to be honest, I think it's, you know, it's probably one of the first novels is like this. And if you look at the language of it and look at the other ones that we've written that were written around this time period, you have to sit there and say, this is probably one of the easiest books we've been able to read as far
Well, yeah, I mean, it was good. I will say that. There was no problem with that at all.
And to me, I mean, you know, I know they gave all, you know, the modern novel. I would say Little Women is probably more closer to the modern novel than what we've read so far.
Yes.
But it's very episodic. And I mean, it's fine. The only thing is that there's nothing that carries you from chapter to chapter. Do you know what I mean? And it would have been quite nice to have a little bit of chapter flow or some drama that would carry from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, that so therefore it'd keep you more involved. But it's kind of like dipping, you know, and it's almost like each one had like its little own little fable or little lesson to be learned. You're like, it doesn't matter, you know, it's not important to be vain. What's important is what you think of yourself. Or money's not everything, because even with poor times you can find love within your family. And it's kind of like each chapter had like its own little
Well, actually they were rich prior, and then when the Civil War came, yeah. I'm assuming that's when they lost their money. And so they were trying to, and I forget what was with the limes. What happened with the limes?
Oh, she hit the limes. Were a big thing, and they were trading.
Oh, yeah.
They were trading them in, and it's a good way to buy friendship. And you know. And then the one woman and the one girl who didn't that she didn't give a pickled lime to is the one that squealed on her, so she got.
Okay, yeah, because I imagine citrus fruits were expensive.
You need to be a good now, because you're not going to get in.
Right.
And then, you know, because Amy was like more of an artist type. And then, mm-hmm. you know, because didn't she draw like a horrible picture of the school teacher anyway?
Which yeah, got she got in trouble. Is that what she got? They had to put the dunce cap on or something?
Yeah. So it's an interesting book. The second part of it, when they become wives, I mean, of course we get, you know, I mean, you know, Little Women, the first book, probably took about 2 or 3 years to write. And then when he got the sequel came out like a year later. So obviously she rushed through the sequel to write it, because, you know, it's like with anything, whether you're, you know, whether it's your first film or not your first film, but your first recording, you know, your first record contract, or whether it's your first book. You spend so much time perfecting that when you write, when the second album or the second book comes out, it does tend to lessen, you know, as far as quality goes. It's very rare. It's very rare that the second book or the second album is as good as the first.
So this is the first book, and there's another one technically.
Part two was a sequel, and they put the two novels.
She did write Little Men and Joe's Boys. I mean, she went on to try to, you know. Oh, she did the All American Girl series too, did she not?
Is this author as popular as Harper Lee? No.
Well, she was in her time. I mean, Harper Lee came around 100 years later. This is about 1868 that this book was released.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And she did it. She goes like Joe in the book. She was trying to get money to take care of her family.
Yeah.
So, you know, she did kind of mingle a couple of personal factoids in there with her novel. I mean, that was probably hard during the Civil War and after the Civil War. Can you imagine? I mean, the chaos. And
I'm sure they were Yankees, weren't they?
They were. Yeah, they were in New England, weren't they? They were Yankees. Yeah. Well, no, what they were in. What state were they in? I can't remember now.
I remember they had snow and ice, so I'm assuming.
They said New England. I know it's a New England state, okay. That I did know. So I'm assuming Massachusetts or maybe even New Hampshire.
New Hampshire or Vermont. Because the thing is, I never found out where exactly they were. It just seemed to be a bit vague. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously Marmy is close enough to Washington where they can get there and back in some kind of amount of time where it isn't, you know, cross country. So
yeah. Well, I knew they were on like the eastern coast. I didn't know what state they were in, sort of thing. I mean, what's quite interesting is that you know, Little Women does question the validity of gender stereotypes, both male and female.
Because
I mean, you know, you have some delicate males, and then you have your rough and tough males, and then you had your, you know, and your various degrees of females as well, which I thought was quite ahead of its time, considering that.
It's very ahead of its time, because she didn't want, like, Joe does not want to be a conventional female. And Lori, what's his first name? That's his middle name. Lori, the male interest there for at least two.
Theodore, yeah. No.
He uses his name Lori as opposed to using his first name. So he's in touch with his feminine side. So you do have a lot of that going on in here, and that is ahead of its time. So you'd be right on that.
Well, I mean, if you look at, Lori is not really a conventional man anyway. He wants to pursue music. And at a time where it was cultured, that was a female thing. Females pursued music, you know, and men were like pursued business or war.
But how do you explain all the great composers?
Mm-hmm. Because they were talented.
It's
different.
but he said that music is for men, for women and not for men back then, which is true. They learned how to play the harpsichord or the piano, or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, men weren't encouraged, I guess.
No, and then if you look at Joe and Lori, which, interestingly enough, they don't end up together by the end, which I thought was interesting in itself. But it was quite interesting that because they're out of the norms of the gender stereotyping, that they always faced on obstacles. They didn't shy away from it. So they were very, very comfortable with who they were as well, which is quite nice, actually, that they were actually very, very comfortable with who they were.
Well, they were kind of selfish, too, though, when you think about it, because remember when Beth gets scarlet fever and she goes to take care of the family that has a baby with scarlet fever, dies of scarlet fever. And was it Meg and Meg and Joe were, I didn't know that once she had scarlet fever, you couldn't catch it again. But they were immune to it, and they sent Beth over. So, I mean, they're just little girls, basically, in this novel, aren't they? 15, 14?
I think they're about the ages between about 13 and 18.
Yeah, age of like 8 till or 9 till 15, something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of left to their own devices, because even the father isn't really in the picture much. You know, he sends him that one note telling them, he's a preacher, isn't he? And he's telling them to be his little women and be forthright and do the right thing. But as women, don't grow, don't have personal growth, don't look out for yourself. just do what your society expects you to. But yeah.
The mothers, I think, is a very strong character.
Very strong. Yeah. They were more upset about mom going away to Washington than they were about the father possibly being ill in Washington, where she had to go get him or go sit with him. So mom was definitely the big, the focal point for the anchor of the family, I would say.
But she also gave them lessons it doesn't matter if you marry rich or poor, just as long as you marry happy, which is a nice message to make, actually.
Right.
And that money doesn't buy everything. And what matters is the people that you're with. And there's all those kind of messages flowing through here. So in a way, they're quite nice messages. I can understand why this book is stood the test of time as far as that is concerned, because those kind of moralistic views are stuff that you should learn, value today.
Oh, it definitely has some really good life lessons in it. I mean, there's really nothing in it that, is obtuse or offensive, or maybe back then, I would imagine that a woman wanting to strive to be an author and stuff would probably be a little frowned upon, maybe, because that's not seemly, maybe.
I think it's at that time where this book is talking about, it's woman was get prepared to get married and be the housewife. If you see the activities while living apart, Joe, she wants to be an actress. But even if she was being an actress, she was performing a man, right? Character.
Well, and she's a tomboy.
Yeah, and it's like one wanted to be the perfect housewife, have a lot of money, and the other one was knitting or doing embroidery and all those things.
Right.
Yeah. I think it shows you what was happening at that time.
I think also what you find also is the necessity of work is a very important issue throughout this book as well. That basically it's your daily work and your daily routine that builds character. And I thought that was quite interesting. And even if you want to accomplish one of your dreams, you're going to have to work. You have to work for everything That is a very American way of looking at things, actually. So little women is very, very American, because you know, I say it to people over here. It's like, and I'm, you know, growing up in American and then growing up in like the English culture sort of thing. And here they'll wait until they get the perfect job before they'll go to work. You know, a lot of people that were, you know, were born and raised here. But in America, we're taught no matter what you do, McDonald's is always hiring. That's what we're taught. Is like, doesn't matter what
they
you do.
They are. Everybody is hiring right now. Everybody's hiring right now, just so that everybody knows.
Yeah. But, I mean, but that's the way that we're raised in America, is that no matter what, you, doesn't matter what's happening. I don't care if you're cleaning streets. I don't care if you're cleaning offices. I don't care if you're cleaning toilets. I don't care if you're working in fast food. All that matters is that you're working. You got to be doing something.
Well, it does say that when they don't engage in any productive work, you know, they end up feeling guilty and or remorseful because of that. So work ethic is definitely a big deal. Even if you don't have a lot of money, it's no matter. I mean, I guess the focus of the book is you don't need a lot to make you happy, but you have to work for it, which is what Keith was saying. And they go on to, almost puritanical, like you said, at this point, because that's just the way the country was founded. It's holy work.
Yeah, there was one part of the as you say, Keith, the mom is saying to them, like, kind of like rich people has their own worries too.
Yes.
And there's something that kind of you come by kind of being proud of who you are by doing something, right? Of what you earn, like doing something like good. Yeah. But I think it was a really nice message.
Well, you also noticed that if something happens, and let's say like when the mom went to Washington, D.C. to take care of the husband and the girls basically got really lazy with the housework and the chores, and then everything falls apart, doesn't it? So whenever they are lazy, there is that lesson that when you are lazy, everything falls apart, because the few times that they decide that, oh, we're going to shirk our duties, we're not going to do what we have to do, everything does fall apart. And then, and then they have to like work extra hard to fix everything that fell apart. So there's also that message, which is kind of true, that if something happens, you let something, you know, it's a bit like if you dust once a week, you're probably quite fine. But if you dust once a month, it's going to be a lot more work, sort of thing. So that message.
I live in Texas. It's dusty all the time.
I mean, another thing that Little Women does teach us, and it goes to great pains to teach us this lesson, that it's important to be genuine. Yeah. And we get like the March sisters, who are quite genuine, really. And then when they aren't genuine, there's a price to be paid. But then they're compared to like the well-to-do set, you know, whether it's Amy Moffat or Sally Gardner, and the other people who are kind of rich and who are not genuine with it. And I thought that was quite a nice message as well. It doesn't matter who you are or what you do. It's just as long as you're genuine about yourself. Which is also a nice message to get as well. And then, you know, Meg and Amy are always constantly struggling with vanity and trying to overcome that.
Right.
You know, but Amy does turn down Fred Vaughn on his marriage proposal, even though he is rich, because she doesn't love him. So, you know, so she does learn a lesson here, though. Everything's money oriented, you know, whether it's Christmas and, you know, I'm gonna buy my mom a small thing of cologne, and that way I'll still have money for myself. And then, of course, at the end of the day, she, you know, sacrifices her whole dollar to
Wasn't Amy the one was holding onto the turquoise ring because that way she had it on, she'd know that not to be superficial or greedy.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And she really worked hard to get that ring. What was from her Aunt March, I believe, the old lady everybody didn't want to spend time with.
Now, another thing that's quite interesting is that Louisa May Alcott actually wrote Little Women as the all-American tale about how being American is better than being the European culture part.
That's because we're more comfortable and happy with our cozy little New England home than our big Parisian castles and mansions.
Well, it said that Americans at the time did not mind coming from humble beginnings and did not crave titles or other superficial trappings of wealth. Americans wanted only what they deserved and believed that they deserved dependent on how hard they worked. So, you know, that's quite an interesting message when you think about it at that time, you know, because, you know, this is about 100 years after we broke away from England, that America became its own government. So
I still think we had a little grudge. We were grinding an axe for at that point because we wanted to get so distanced from that whole culture at that time. And now we just can't get enough of the royal family over here. Can't get enough of Meghan and Harry in the States.
Do you reckon that is their last name is March, connected that in March is the International Women's Day?
I don't know.
I was thinking now, I turned around the book and I thought, maybe it's because of that.
Who knows? Well, you never
maybe
know.
Women's Day became because of this book. Because it is considered one of the greatest feminist novels for its time period.
Yeah.
And I'm not so much what happens. I don't know what goes on now, you know. But I know
it's more of an awakening novel, really.
It's one that a lot of female girls read around their teenage years, I find. You know, yeah, I mean, I've never, this is the first time I've read it. So, you know, it felt like it was like each chapter is like watching an episode of Little House on the Prairie for me.
It is. That's a good analogy because it's exactly what it is, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, but it did miss, you know, Mrs. Olsen and Nellie. I mean, it needed to have a Nellie in there somewhere. Because well, Little House on the Prairie is still one of my favorite episodes. I wasn't too fussed about Laura and Mary and the Ingalls family. I just wanted the townsfolk. Now, there's a lot of symbolism in the book as well. Umbrellas play a big symbolism where if men offer a woman an umbrella, they're offering to shield them or to protect them.
Yeah.
And whenever one of the March sisters refused the umbrella, it means that they didn't want that man to protect them or shield them from anything, which is quite an interesting thing as well, considering that umbrellas shield you from the rain and protect you from the rain. So that was quite nice.
I can hold my own umbrella.
And burning seemed to be a big thing in here as well. Whenever burning happened in there, whether it's the burning, any burning Joe's manuscript or other way burning in this,
right,
they were, you know, they represented like anger and burning desire, they had a burning desire. It was like this geniusness going on it, which is quite bizarre actually. Cause I mean, for me, I guess I would always consider burning to be destructive.
Could be also a purifying thing.
Yeah. Purifying as well.
Mm. Although I'd rather use water.
I mean, I did find that music seemed to be another motif that was used in this, that, you know, it seemed to bring them all together, and that they all, for all the four daughters and the mother, all had refined a voice. So, and that kind of bring people together, and it was a way for them to form bonds with each other. And when days are bad, they sing to make them happy. If days were good, they sing to be joyous. And
well, it's not like they had Xbox or cable TV or Netflix back then. So, I mean, they read and they sang as entertainment. I mean, that's just the way that the culture was back then. And most of the women folk probably would be alone and have to, you know, take care of the homes because this was the Civil War. And even after Reconstruction and all that stuff started, I mean, there was a lot of people didn't come home, you know, that was a brutal war.
Well, another thing that Little Women has is all about teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the father, he's a congregational minister.
You got the
mother is the wife of a transcontinental minister. So she's teaching what her husband's taught her and teaching it to the children. The girls marry teachers. And you know, and then, you know, at the end, Joe opens up a school for boys. So it's all about teaching, isn't it? Which is quite interesting.
Teaching lessons.
Yeah.
What did you think about the teacher hit Amy in her hands?
I think they should bring that back. No, I mean...
No, but...
They used to do that up until about the 80s. 90s, 1880s.
Yeah, that's where I was going, because I remember when I was in school, but it didn't happen. But my dad used to tell me that I think in his time used to happen. So it was 1970s, maybe, something like that, 1960s, probably. So it was like, I don't know, each country, you know, like, maybe these days the thing go faster due to internet, but in those days, maybe the progress that was in one country and another was like later was happening. So I don't know. I was thinking about asking about what do you think?
The problem with, I mean, the thing is, the problem basically is with corporal punishment in schools is that it's only as good as the teacher sort of thing. So if you got like a really nasty teacher, they would actually overdo it. If you had like a good,
we had corporal punishment in our schools, as you all know.
Yeah, I mean, but they're a good teacher, and then chances are they would only use it if all else fails. And then there are other teachers that would do it
for shits just and
at the very beginning. Before they, and we had a teacher that basically would just throw an eraser at you. You're talking like, poof.
I used to have notes
sailing across the room.
Sister Esther used to hit me with dictionary.
And look at you now.
Look at me. There's nothing words. Wrong with me at all. I turned out fine.
Reading novels like that.
I mean, I guess, the thing is, I don't think corporal punishment is a bad thing. Unfortunately, is that
it could be a bad thing misused.
Yeah, and it tends to, you kind of, it's funny, but you always remember the teachers who misused it.
Yes.
They're the ones that kind of stay with you for the rest of your life. And I mean, the thing, it's kind of funny, but at the time that, would you ever receive any of these kind of punishments, other than teachers, raising you up by your ear and dragging you down the hallway or whatever.
Or like, your hair in third grade. Yep. Mm-hmm. I remember that too. Mr. Horshaw.
Yeah, mine was Mr. Powers. And the thing is, you remember these teachers for the rest of your life.
I know.
You laugh about it now. I mean, it's humiliating and horrible at the time, but now you kind of laugh at it.
I know. Well, yeah, it's funny now.
I remember the two things when I was at school. Like, sometimes they were never physical punishment, but maybe they ask you to stand up and go to the front, and maybe you will have to be standing there. And I don't know, they were doing like like 15 minutes, 10 minutes.
Stand on the corner.
Yeah, no, not in the corner. Maybe standing up and being there, right? Or maybe if you have to talk about something, they were asking you questions, like a kind of exam, but for all the whole class. They were asking you things that you have to be on the front, and then maybe the professor will go back to the back. So it's kind of like you're kind of giving a lecture to everyone, right? And I remember once they were like, sometimes they used to ask you to leave the room, so you were staying outside of the whole class, not knowing what was going on. But I remember once I was in secondary school, and I think they took two or three students outside, and then they were scared they went to play football. They were not here. So then they stopped doing that.
We had a coach in IHC. Remember Coach LeDuc, Keith? You must remember him a little bit.
Roughly. I didn't think.
I used to send all the boys to Coach LeDuc when they were bad.
Yeah. I actually got out of gym class in IHC, so.
You don't know how you pull off half the crap you did.
I guess we talked mainly about the beginning of the book. But I guess let's talk about part two of the book where they start getting married and the death of Beth, which, to be honest, I mean, when she died, I didn't really feel that much of a loss for her because she was kind of a mousy character anyway.
She reminded me of Olivia de Havilland in Gone with the Wind. Remember her? What was her name? Oh, my God. I can't remember.
Melanie.
Melanie, yes. Yeah, Melanie was the same thing. Yeah. Mousy and so self. She didn't talk a lot. But she was the smartest of the bunch, basically, though.
The thing is that when I watched Gone with the Wind recently, because I thought, oh, my God, they're going to ban it. So I'll watch it because I probably not be able to see it again. But they haven't banned it. But I did watch it, all 4 hours of it.
I love it.
4 hours.
Gone with the Wind. Yeah, it's 4 hours long.
I have never seen it. But whoa.
It's a brilliant film, actually.
I loved it.
And everything like this. But I have to sit there and say that when I was watching it, and the thing is out. I mean, I've seen it before, and I always think of Melanie as, like, the mousy one or whatever like this.
Right.
watching it this time around is like, I actually prefer Scarlett because you know where you stood with Scarlett. Yeah. Melanie, she's conniving little cow. I'm sorry, yeah. But this is like, she's back to
a little bit.
She's just passive aggressive all the way there. She's just passive aggressive.
But you would have thought that she would have come down hard on Scarlett after she gets caught with Ashley Wilkes in the kissing booth, so to speak, you know, because you had the mean aunts that's like, oh, there's Scarlett and there's Ashley
Wilkes. But she does it another way. She kills her with kindness, which is even worse.
She actually loved her, I think. And she couldn't possibly think that Scarlett would do anything wrong.
Well, I think she did. I just thought
Devlin had a mouth like a stormtrooper. Yeah. She was not mousy in real life.
But see, I think Melanie basically knew exactly what she's doing, and she knew exactly that if I played the victim and be all sweet and stuff like this,
I guess that's a way of looking at it.
Yeah, because it's funny though. When I saw it the first time around, I was like, oh, she's a victim, da da da. Not victim in like millennial victim, but right. Victim. But then when I watched this time, I was like, oh my god, she's actually conniving. She knows exactly what she's doing. She's not sweet.
I didn't see her that way. I thought she just loved Scarlett so much that she couldn't think that Scarlett would do anything wrong, let alone seduce Ashley.
Watch it again with that mindset I gave you, and it's funny.
I'll watch it again. Well, the thing is, like, Ashley was such a wet blanket. I don't understand why they want to fight over such a wet noodle like him. I have never understood that, why women fight over men like that. Now, Rhett Butler, I could get it. Everybody needs to fight over Rhett because he's like a man's man, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's what Beth reminded me of, Olivia de Havilland and Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. Melanie.
Yeah, and then she was always very, very shy. And she's very, when she got to know Lori's grandfather, and it was kind of like, you know, hiding behind the girls, you know, petticoats and so on and so forth. So. I mean, it was interesting. The three sisters are very, very distinctive, and I have to give Louisa May Alcott that she's made sure that each of the three sisters are very, very distinct, sort of thing. But what do you think about them getting married at the end, Leandro? Do you think do you think it was a cop out for the book, or especially with Joe getting married, or do you think it was kind of a natural way to happen for them?
Yeah, natural way, I think. I don't know. I mean, there was kind of it was something that you expect that it was going to happen, you can expect that thing was going to happen one way or the other.
I mean, I think that, we knew that Meg was going to get married anyway. I thought it was a nice twist to get Amy married off to Lori. I thought that, because I didn't see that coming at all, because I didn't think that there was,
You ended up in Europe together. Didn't you kind of see that happening, because she turned down the other guy, that Frank, because he was rich, and she just didn't want to marry him because he was rich. And Lori just happened to seem like a convenient love interest.
Well, I mean, I guess when I meant when I said that I didn't see them, that coming together. I mean, once they got in Europe, I mean, that's different. But the thing is, like, there's really no interaction between Amy and Lori throughout the whole book whatsoever.
Well, she was a little girl then, wasn't she? Like 12, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, like, there's the Meg interest in Lori. There's maybe Beth interested in Lori, but it's almost like, but there's no interaction about Amy and Lori whatsoever. Of course, when they wound up in Europe together, I mean, and let's face it, I mean, they were brought together through grief of Beth's death, really, weren't they? So, because Amy couldn't get home. The mom told her to stay in England, stay in Europe, and come across Lori, and Lori gives her a shoulder to cry on, sort of thing. And because it's a bit of home coming to where you are. So that way it makes grieving a little bit easier when you're in a foreign country. So, I mean, that came together. I thought, it was a nice marriage. Meg married the right people. I mean, they all married the right people for them. I mean, Joe, even the person she married, I mean, he was a bit older than she was, but it was someone that was going to marry her on her own terms and meet her. So it's not going to be anyone that's going to be owning Joe. That's like a partnership marriage, which is quite nice. So even though,
and
I can understand why you kind of have to marry them off, because you either married at that time or you were a spinster.
Yeah, it was kind of a stigmatizing thing for the day. But, you know, on the other hand, they kind of, especially Jo, she just kind of does the married wife thing. And I found it as a kind of like a big letdown as opposed to the beginning of the novel, which was a separate. Because they all had these hopes.
She didn't give up anything, does she? She didn't give up a writing career.
Well, it just seemed like that's just the way it was back then. You had to get married. It didn't mean how progressive you wanted to be. You had to get married because that just was expected of you. You got married to help take care of the family, basically. And, you know, she kind of, I guess Jo didn't even really marry well. Well, actually, she kind of was okay because she got the house, the old house that Aunt Marge lived in, and they turned it into a school for boys. So, I mean, they did. Yeah, it's a little progressive for society and women, I guess.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I didn't see that. I didn't see this Jo selling out because the thing is, Jo, I think if she was selling out, she would have married Lori, her best friend, which, you know, she didn't. She didn't for various reasons.
Well, like the mom said, they were too much the same. They would have, it would have never worked. They would have been butting heads constantly, probably.
And then the person that she does marry is someone who loves her for her mind and her writing, and that actually makes her writing better.
Wasn't he critical of her, though?
He was critical of her writing, not critical of her as a person, critical of her writing. And, you know, what he said, he goes, no, you need to simplify your stories. You need to be, she goes, well, you know, it's hard to be Shakespeare. He goes, no, just be Jo, just be yourself. You don't need to be another Shakespeare. We got a Shakespeare. You just need to be Jo March.
Right.
And then she rewrites her book, which sells, and she gets a publishing deal, sells well for her. Of course, she goes home because of Beth's death, and then he comes after her, and she kind of, he marries her on her own terms. She's still going to be Jo, she's just going to be married, but it's going to be married to a guy that's going to let her be who she wants to be. She doesn't have to be what he wants her to be. She's going to be who she wants to be, just a better version of herself.
But there's still that societal element that did put the boot on the neck of female existence back then. I mean,
men had to get married as well, though.
But women were in a caste system, if you like, you know. I mean, they had to. Mm. Well, actually, they could marry up. They were socially mobile. But I mean, they were just expected. They weren't expected to have brains. They were expected to marry well. I mean, that's just not really. I mean, knowing what I know now as a 2000s woman, I guess, or whatever, you know, all the opportunity we have now as opposed to then.
The Marx sisters didn't marry for money, though. At the end, did they? They married for love.
Yeah. Money doesn't suck, though.
So they did keep to their own moral systems. You know, they could have done the whole Pride and Prejudice and Mr. Darcy and all that kind of crap. I'm not a Jane Austen fan whatsoever.
So I apologize
to the many of her fans.
Well, I didn't mind Pride and Prejudice, but.
Oh, I just thought that's basically women wanting to marry rich. It didn't matter if they fell in love, they wanted to
marry rich. That's really all it was about, wasn't it? I mean, it was all about.
Which is an English novel, but then if you look at the American, which this came out the same time, which is like, no, you marry for love. If you marry for love, it doesn't matter if they're rich or poor. All that matters is that you'll be happy. You need to marry for happiness. Yeah. And I guess what we do get in the second part of this is that we do get that message that they all married for love and they all married to be happy.
What the mother told them, like they got the message.
Yeah, basically, and I had something to say that the husbands that they married to do suit them.
They do.
Meg's husband suits hers. You know, Amy and Lori are fine because Amy's going to need someone that's going to test her, and Lori's got the patience of a saint, so that's going to work well. And as far as Jo is concerned, she married someone she's still going to be Jo. I mean, she'll be just a married version of Jo, but she's still going to be Jo. I mean, it's her idea to open the school for boys. It's her idea to be a teacher, and she gets to teach, and she gets to do her theater and write her plays and write her books, and she's still going to continue writing. So she's doing everything, and I guess running a school, because she'd be running a school full time, she'd probably just get people into like clean the house for her because she didn't like that part of it anyway.
The right to vote up until 100 years, actually, this weekend. You know, it was 100 years this weekend. Women finally
got. Worst thing that ever happened.
And it took 15 more years for ladies. And it took 15 more years for ladies of color, or was it 15 or 20 after, you know, white women were allowed to vote for women of color and ethnicity to vote. So, I mean, we've come a long way, baby.
Okay, what are our final thoughts of Little Women, the novel overall? And starting with you, Vix.
I think it's a good novel. I mean, it's a chick flick novel kind of thing, you know? I mean, I know that poor Leandro probably suffered through it. I'm just looking at his face. But it's actually not a bad, I mean, it really does put you in the relevant era of women and coming of age for these girls and making decisions. You know, it's about familial duty and duty to oneself. So, I mean, I had to read it when I was a small young woman. I mean, I think a lot of little girls kind of start off with this novel. I mean, it's a cool novel if you're younger, you know, knowing what I know now, I would probably say down with the patriarchy yet again. But no, I mean, it's a good novel. I think all little girls should read it, or women for that matter. And if men are in touch with their feminine side, such as your good selves, they will read it too.
Maybe. What about yourself, Leandro?
Well, we read before this of the picture of Dorian Gray, where I found it a bit like going like slow, you know, like the story is like, come on, man, stop describing, I don't know, how is the cup and go for the story. This right. one, I liked it because it was like easy to read, right? Like faster, right. The details goes like straight in your mind, and I like it because like have every like chapter is like a little story, so you're not like reading forever about something.
Right.
I like the story. I mean, and I think it's a really cool to give you like a view of how was the things at that time, and make me think. You know, like in my personal case, like I remember my grandma. When I was between 4 and 9 years old, that we start to find things that she has done when she was married, like embroidery and linen, you know, for the, but all like, you know, made by Hannah, even things made by her mom. And I remember that my dad used to tell me, you know, how what used to be when he was growing up. And it was really interesting because it's like I could link it with a lot of things that were happening in this story. My grandma used to watch some programs on TV or read certain magazines that were specifically for housewives, right? And were like kind of like teaching how to cook, how to read, and how to be kind of like be the, well, they used to call it like the heart of the house, right? Right, that was not the heart of the house, that was the authority of the house. So kind of like that thing of like, who is the bad one and the good one, let's say. I enjoyed the story. No, I really like it. And also to tell you about how was like this story in like in that particular time and place. So yeah, I wouldn't read it again, but I like it.
I wouldn't read it again.
I think myself, I think this is a book that should be read at bedtime, and you read one chapter every night before you go to bed. And I think that this is how
I agree with that.
Enjoyed. Yes.
My unfortunately for myself is that I actually thought this was a short book. I could read this in a week, and I realized that I actually was, I spent you know, like 3 to 4 hours a day reading this. And that's, you know, I thought, I'll be able to get this off in a couple of days. It's not a problem. And then when I was reading it, I realized that it was episodic, which is not a bad, it's not a bad thing whatsoever. But, you know, I can understand why this is probably read to, you know, parents read it to their daughters, you know, a chapter before they're going to bed, because it kind of deserves that kind of thing where you read each chapter, reflect on that chapter, move on. And you kind of get like, yeah, I said before, like Little House on a Prairie or an episodic television series. I think that I think it's a very important book. I think that it teaches people to, it teaches you to be genuine, be true to yourself. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. All that matters is what kind of person you are. And I think that, you know, those values and lessons that, you know, from a book that's written in the 1800s should be very, very much alive today, which is something that we tend to forget. I mean, you know, we're in a era of social media where it's all about your looks and filtering yourself and how everything's supposed to be and what you're supposed to be. And this book is not about what you're supposed to be. It's about who you are. And it's, I thought that was quite a nice message. Yeah. And you can do that through personal growth. And, you know, and, you know, another important thing about this book that I thought was quite important is that none of them are victims of their situation. If they do something wrong or they find themselves in a bad situation, you take ownership, you take responsibility for it,
you learn from it,
and you move forward. And I thought that was a very, I thought the lesson was very, very good. So,
words to live by, own it.
You're right. And I like that thing that, for example, the mother was also, you know, telling, you know, like good advices. For example, like when it started, they went to the house in Christmas time. They went to the house of people that were living in a really, really bad situation. They're poor, and then help them out, you know, and cook something for them. Like I kind of, they donate their breakfast. And this kind of make them understand that, okay, maybe you're complaining because, oh no, this Christmas you're not having what you like, but there are people that maybe are not having not this Christmas, like every day.
Well, I mean, that's also an important lesson to learn as well, that even though you might be going through a bad time, there's always someone going through something worse.
Oh, there's always, suffering more or worse, you know?
And, you know, the thing is, it's not, you know, the world's not about you. The world is, you know, the world is about being kind to each other, showing compassion to each other, and basically, you know, be a good person. If you're a good person, the world will, you know, the world will turn out right for you. You just have to be good and take ownership and learn, you know, do what you have to do. And I think the messages in this book are universal, and they're great, great messages. So brings us to Little Women, the 1933 film. Now, Little Women is a pre-code drama film directed by George Cukor and starring Katharine Hepburn, Joan Bennett, Frances D. and Jean Parker. The screenplay was by Sarah A. Y. Mason and Victor Herman. It's based on the 1869 to 1869 two-volume novel of the same name by Louisa May Alcott. This is the third screen adaptation of the book. It was followed two silent versions, the first released in 1917 with Minnie Gray, and the second in 1918 with Dorothy Bernard, which were both silent. After this 1933 sound version came the 1949 version of Little Women with June Allison, Elizabeth Taylor, and Peter Lawford, and 1994 film with Little Women starring Winona Ryder, and of course the 2009 film that came out last a couple years ago, featuring Saoirse Ronan. So what we'll do is cut to the trailer and be right back to discuss Little Women from 1933.
don't have to go to that nasty old Davis school with impertinent girls who laugh at your dresses and label your father if he isn't rich.
Libel, libel. Don't say label as if Papa were a pickle bottle.
I know what I mean, and you needn't be satirical about it. It's proper to use good words and improve your vocabulary.
Aren't we elegant?
He looks pretty grim, but I shouldn't be afraid of him. Though I can see how his face might frighten some people.
Thank you, Mom. But my face would frighten some people.
Oh, I only said might, sir.
But with all that, you like me, eh?
Oh, yes, sir, I do. I do, I do.
And I like you.
No, we never can be boy and girl again, Laurie. Those happy old times can't come back. And we shouldn't expect them to.
Oh, that trip to Europe that you so looked forward to. Oh, that is too bad. That's a cruel disappointment. And on the top, the stupid professor comes blundering and makes things worse.
Oh, but Joe, I think I'll be homesick for you, even in heaven. If you really want Bessie, please wait until Mommy comes home. But, oh God, please don't.
Hello, welcome back to the Literary License Podcast, and we discussed the 1933 film, Little Women. So starting with you, Vix, what's your thoughts of Little Women, the 1933 film?
I really liked it. Well, I like the old silver screen stuff. I have a hard time disliking any of them. But, you know, I think it was me. I was talking to you about it, about Katharine Hepburn. She was just like really overdoing the Joe part, though. I love Katharine Hepburn. Don't get me wrong. But, oh, my God, she was just so out there, even for Joe, I think. But then again, you know, go big or go home with Katharine Hepburn. But I thought that it tried to stick to the story or at least condense the story as best it could. I thought they did a good job doing that, actually. I love the old silver screen image. I thought it was beautifully filmed, you know, and I really got a kick out of seeing Joan Bennett so young, you know, because after all these years, I did not realize it was Joan Bennett. I'm realizing I didn't realize a lot of things in my old age.
When you say Joan Bennett is the singer. No,
Joan Bennett, she plays the matriarch in Dark Shadows. She plays.
Yeah, we covered Dark Shadows in one of our other episodes, and she's the main actress in that, but she's older. Yeah. This is like years.
She's just a little thing.
If you're into horror films, Joan Bennett did one of the most classic Italian horror films called Suspiria. She's in that. So, and what about yourself, DeAndre? What do you think of the film?
Yeah, as Vicky said, that actress was really like over exaggerated, and it was really weird because it was one, the one that was playing, I think her name was Amy, the little one. Like, it was like 30 years old playing to be someone that is really, really small. That was really weird.
They were all really young for this, though. I mean, I didn't realize that. Who was it? Not Gene Parker. Who played Beth?
Frances D.
Was that her?
Yeah.
Where are all these really, really famous actresses? I don't know. I don't know any of them. So,
Katharine Hepburn is Joe.
I have heard the name, but I haven't seen it. I don't
know. The Iron Blue again, you know, on Golden Pond and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Joe Bennett is Amy. I mean, they're all quite newish. I mean, Katharine Hepburn would explode after this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Joan Bennett playing Amy, the youngest one. I think she must have been a bit too old, considering that she didn't tell anyone that she was pregnant when she was filming this, and they had to keep hiding
her pregnancy. I did not find that little interesting factoid.
Yeah, they had to keep hiding her pregnancy.
How do you know all these details?
Because I did my research.
Yeah. Dig.
No, I'm
digging.
But yeah, so there's that. I have to agree that I think Katharine Hepburn was, it's almost like she was on speed or something. She was just like,
well, Katharine Hepburn is real. You know, it was like something she was trying to prove, you know.
Yeah.
One cool thing about this movie is the RKO released it at the perfect time because depression audiences at that time were not wanting to see all the vulgarities of riches and, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous. They wanted to see simple, you know, and less auspicious, you know, view of the world, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it came at a good time. It was a successful film.
I also have to sit there and say that it's quite ingenious that George Cukor is known as the female director. You know, female actresses love working with George Cukor, and he knew how to film them, and he knew how what kind of roles they should have and stuff like this. He also did The Women and various other films as well, and always with strong female characters. And I thought that was interesting that with the Marx sisters, if you watch the film again, that what you'll notice is that the clothes that they're wearing that they start out with, you notice that the same clothes that they're wearing get moved from sister to sister.
Yes.
To each other's clothes.
He did definitely pay attention to that detail, I will say.
I thought that was fantastic considering that, you know, normally what you would get with a Hollywood production is like, oh, you know, you never seen the same clothes twice, and God forbid it'll be on another actress. Here is like to emphasize that they are struggling financially.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, you know, and that's what happens when you're with a family, you know, basically it's like, you know, my sisters are trading on clothes, and, you know, I didn't trade clothes with my sisters very often, but I mean, they would wear my t-shirts and stuff.
So they did start it off with Joan Bennett sitting in the dunce cap with the dunce chair, you know, so they kind of stuck with that. I wonder how old she was in this. This is going to drive me nuts now.
Yeah. But I really like those details because, you know, for example, that to me makes it more real. Like, for example, if you're struggling economically, well, maybe you will be wearing the same clothes for a longer time than maybe if you have a lot of money, right? And this is a personal thing. I used to do publicities when I was living in Argentina, and there's sometimes that the director was like, not, for example, they wanted to show this, and instead of doing it in this way that you could see, they were doing like in a crazy way that cannot be real, right? Like, I don't know, like, as you said, it's like, I don't know, I love to watch a movie and said, find those little details to say, oh yeah, this is how it should be, like more in a real story.
Yeah. It just makes more sense. And it's kind of like,
yeah.
I guess, I don't know if you noticed it the first time around, but I've seen this film a couple times, and it's like, I did know that I need to look out for it. I actually did look out for it this time around. I was like, oh my God, that's quite cool, actually. What's another thing, another good tidbit about this is that George Cukor cast Joan Bennett as the part of Amy after meeting her and she was inebriated. And he thought that she the inebriated at a party because, oh, that's my Amy. So that's quite interesting.
Do you also know that this school during during the depths of the Depression, it became a what do you call it? A staple. They made the school curriculum show it because apparently it was just so perfect for that time of the Depression because they do look sad. They do look sadly impoverished from being. They probably were well off. I don't know what a minister being well off though. I don't understand how the minister could be well off, but he wasn't
filming. Well, I mean, you can do quite well in a church if you have the right.
Well, I know. Well, I'm not saying he's Kenneth Copeland or anything like that, but no. You know, or Jimmy Swaggart. But you know, I guess they could be.
Something happened to the congregation. Well, I guess what it is that basically is that if you've gone off to war. You're no longer getting the money in from the church, are you?
Yeah.
Because you're no longer preaching in that church. So you're preaching for the state.
So they're going to get all those fancy ribbons and bows on a preacher salary. I think me and you have been doing all the wrong things all of our life. We need to start our own church, Keith.
Well, if we did, we'd get everything tax-free. So it'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
I do think, you know, I think overall it's a nice film. You kind of watch and you just watch and it kind of washes over you. I think Katharine Hepburn was a bit high octane for the role of Jo.
She's always been high octane. No, the woman has just so much energy and enthusiasm for every role. She attacks every role.
Well, I don't know. I understand what you say. It's like when an actor is acting in a movie that's kind of playing a play. I don't know if
you understand. Yeah, it felt like a play, actually. Sounds like she's on stage.
Instead of doing like in a normal way, she was like too much. And I think there's no need.
Yeah, everything was, even her hand movements and everything that she did was so big. It's almost like, you know, it's like she was on a stage production. And, you know, I know that she's doing, like when she's doing her play production in the movie, Joe's putting on one of the plays that she's written and she's doing these great big, you know, that makes sense. But when she's playing Joe, it doesn't make sense. When she's not on that stage doing that.
Is she still alive? No.
Oh, Catherine Hepburn.
She died. Yeah.
So she won't be able to find us.
She lasted a long time. I mean, I loved her in On Golden Pond. I really love that movie. A lot of people hate it and make fun of it, you know, with the strawberries, Norman, you know. But I really love that movie.
Balloons are on Golden Pond.
Balloons. Balloons.
She needed to have a way of talking like the Calla Lilies are in bloom.
Again. Oh, I know, the Calla Lilies are in full bloom. Yeah, I remember the Calla Lilies.
I mean, she's a good actress. I just think that she was just a bit. I think it's like, I guess she probably, I think it's because everyone else's roles are quite toned down.
Yeah,
that she might have wanted it.
Yes.
Maybe she. Either they should have brought all their stuff up to her level, or she should have just kind of calmed down a little bit, sort of thing. Because when I'm reading Joe in the book, Joe is forthright and Joe's very true to her word, but she's not overly.
No.
Over. I mean, you know, she needs Ritalin. I mean,
she does. She's like a fidget spinner in this role. And I love Catherine Hepburn. Don't get me wrong. Maybe she was dating what's his face, the aviator this time, wasn't she? Or was that later?
I don't know. All I know is that what should have been an ensemble movie ends up becoming a Catherine Hepburn movie.
And it was overwhelming. Her presence was overwhelming. It was.
All the other sisters got lost.
It did take away from the other girls.
Well, we didn't get to see Amy in Europe at all. We didn't get Meg kind of gets married. I mean, Meg disappears and then she shows up and gets married. You know, so we didn't get that. We didn't, you know, and I just think that they could have been able, they could have like sorted out a little bit more.
A little bit.
Catherine Laurie as well, which, you know, and maybe, you know, if you're going to condense, I know you're going to have to condense the book, otherwise you're gonna
do it. There's no way.
Which they did do a little one.
They did do a good job, I thought. You know, everybody got married in the end. They kind of swung it around for a good hour and 40-minute movie. I mean, I thought they did a pretty good job condensing what they could as far as Hollywood goes. I mean, they hit all the major points and all the ups and downs. But if you watch the what's the episodic is that Winona Ryder in it playing Joe? I think.
Yeah, there's
they do the episodes. That's a really good version of it if people are really wanting to see it further. I really enjoyed that one. I didn't watch it this week, obviously, but I have seen it, and it does a good job.
Yeah, with Christian Bale on it. And,
yes, yeah.
I mean, there's also the 1970s TV version, which is available on YouTube, that stars Susan Day from the Partridge Family.
Oh, yeah, that we talked about that. I totally forgot about that version. That was excellent, too.
The Brady Bunch, and that, I think that runs like 8 episodes, and that actually does a very, very good job of being quite true. I do think that with this movie, I think if they wanted a better representation of the book, they probably could have cut some of Joe's storylines out. Mm-hmm. And included some of the other sisters and just so made it a bit more, you know, because you don't really get a lot of the family together either. You get like, you got the beginning with the Christmas and you got them all together.
Right.
And then, yeah, the rest of them is not so much with the family. It's more like Joe, you know, Joe meets Laurie. Joe goes to Laurie's house. Joe writes a story. Joe does a school play. Joe, you know, it was more like that. So I guess that my only disappointment.
Precisely.
And I do, and then the thing is like I would have liked to see more. I mean, maybe they had to do that because of Joan Bennett's pregnancy.
You know, how pregnant was she? You know, I'm going to have to go look all this stuff up when I get off the computer with you guys. That's going to drive me nuts now. I always try to find the nitty gritty stuff, and I didn't see that anywhere. Maybe it's...
Well, Walter Plunkett created a dress for her character, and for Amy. But he had to redesign several Joan Bennett's costumes to conceal her advancing pregnancy, a condition Bennett intentionally had not mentioned to Cukor when he cast her in the film.
Oh, wow. They never gave David O. Selznick any screen credit. I did not know that either.
Did he own RKO, or he was one of the owners of RKO?
Well, it said that David O. Selznick received no screen credit. He returned to RKO from MGM to supervise the production as the last film left in his contract with the studio, and they never gave him credit for it.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
He was a big name. I mean, O. Selznick, he did it all.
I mean, what's quite interesting is George Cukor and I did an interview about Little Women. He says, when I directed Little Women, I had to develop a new technique to ensure the best results in the collaboration of Miss Hepburn and myself. I find actress Katharine Hepburn is more than a personality. She's a human dynamo without meaning to be. And simply because of the vigor of her own mind and intensity of her attitude towards her own work, she can be, if given the chance, that I would call it an artistic bully. I do not say that I had to decide to lie down to her from the start. A less good picture would have resulted, but a director with a conscience will fight tooth and nail to get the picture he wants it to be. Let me hasten to say that Miss Hepburn and I did not fight at all. I confess freely that I used many weapons in dealing with her, simulated rage, ridicule, and good humor. She has a good sense of humor and is capable of directing it against herself. So this pretty much tells you what Katharine Hepburn is like on stage. And I think it does show that he's got, you know, he's
right. Kind of a spitfire. That people will say that she was a spitfire. I would love to see like the outtakes from this actually. Cause I know that the Gone with the Wind outtakes are great. Cause Olivia de Havilland, she just cusses all the time.
Well, I imagine that, for example, when for the writer, it's easy to kind of moderate jokes because, you know, for example, one chapter is about one person, the other one is another person. Right. But when you make the movie, that the character is there, and maybe the other character is like the actress, let's say, is not strong enough, the personality or how he's doing the thing, maybe that will make also that the other person, that is Joe, that is really like vivid, and I always have a passion for adventures, is like get over like easily. And plus, if you have another personality of this actress that is like more, is like, yeah, too much maybe. But I think that, I mean, being fair, I think that's a mistake of the director. The director should be saying, okay, look, I don't know, in this scene, bring it a bit down, like keep it up, but not so up that.
Apparently, that's what he was doing for her, and we still got this performance.
Oh, they tell her to tone it down, right?
He was telling her to tone it down, and she was toning it down. So, God forbid, if he let her have free reign, what she could have done.
I'm trying to remember what movie was her first movie. I'm going to have to go back and look because I'm just wondering.
I mean, the thing is, I guess with the character of Joe, anyway, Joe does overshadow Little Women, the book, anyway. It's kind of like Joe, then Amy, then Meg, and then Beth comes at the very last because Beth's really hard to. There's not really much of a personality there, but so it does make sense that Joe would shine through the movie, I guess. But I do think that there probably would have been a way to balance it out just a little bit more because it did feel like Joe's story, and it does feel like if it's called Little Women, you should just call Little Women Joe's story. Then you could have done Little Women Amy's story. You know what I mean? And maybe you could do the four films of it or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, the other sister didn't get much of a look in, and
well, Beth was kind of phased out because we really didn't need her anymore, did we? Because she was going to never get married.
Yeah, but the thing is that it would have met more if you got some more about her, because when she died, she's like, eh.
Yeah, business as usual after Beth dies. I mean, you know, when somebody dies, I'm just like a lunatic for a while.
Well, when she has scarlet fever in the movie. And the thing is like, you don't know if she's going to live or die.
Right.
And it's like, you should be feeling that anguish. And I actually didn't feel anything. I was like, okay. And then she doesn't die, but she's weakened by it. And then when she does die, you're like, and the thing is, they're crying and oh my God, she's gone. But you're like, that's what I'm saying. It's like, but if we had, we had some more Beth in there, when she did go, we would have felt that she was missing. But it's just like,
yeah.
Now, if Katharine Hepburn played Beth, and someone else played Joe, then when Beth died, you would have missed Katharine Hepburn with that accent.
Yeah, don't you? That's definite. That's a definite. I like Katherine Hepburn, though. I mean,
I do like her. I just thought that
she was real strong for this. I could see maybe not so much Vivian Leigh. Who would, or maybe what's her name? Somebody would have toned it down more.
Which other movie did she made?
Katherine Hepburn did Woman of the Year with Spence. Look Who's Coming to Dinner. I mean, she's in tons of movies. If you look her up, I mean,
oh God, Katherine Hepburn.
She's a Hollywood icon. Katherine Hepburn is. So.
Is she was in Casablanca? No. No.
No,
that's Ingrid Bergman.
Okay.
Yeah. No, Ingrid Bergman. We're going to make you a cinephile yet.
I guess what we'll discuss is let's discuss the difference between the book and the film, and which do you prefer, starting with you, Vix?
Well, I kind of liked them equally, tell you the truth. I liked the book. I can't say I loved it because I you know how I feel about towards the end. I just think that kind of lost its shine a little bit because that the rebel in me always appreciates the rebel and you know, in the other person, the insurrectionist in the other person, I guess. But I thought it was a good book. I think all girls or even boys for that matter should read it. It's a really good, it really does portray the time because the author was in, you know, indeed in that time and kind of reflecting on her life. You know, the movie, I love the old silver screen stuff. I think it's just pretty to look at for one. And it's just, there's something ethereal about it as opposed to, you know, all the CGI and everything we've got now. And I thought actually they did a good job translating the book onto the screen because, you know, they had to leave out a lot. We know that because when you get the other, the newer versions, you have 8 to 10 episodes of whatever. So, you know, they don't cover everything, but I think they hit all the major points, you know, what the point they were trying to get across. And there was a happy ending. I mean, you know, there was death, there was struggle, there was, you know, all kinds of stuff going on, but it didn't leave you feeling like, ugh, I'm going to cry into my pillow though. So I think that they both complement each other actually. So I would say that, well, obviously they did complement each other because they put it into some of the school's curriculums this, you know, during the Great Depression. So obviously it, you know, resonates with people.
What about yourself, Leandro?
Well, I prefer the book. I mean,
you don't like Katherine Hepburn, we know.
No. I don't know. It's like I like the way the author that describes things, right? Because it's not really like poetically way. It's just go to the point, and you can have an image in your head like straight away. I don't know. I mean, I like the way she tells the story, you know, like she's telling you what's going on, of course, right? But also you can imagine the how the place could be, you know, where they are. I like when I was reading at that part that they went to visit this family that was for Christmas, I could imagine, you know, how could that room could be, you know, with the said they would have the windows broken and it was really cold. And actually could imagine, you know, what they were doing, the action they were doing. The thing is, like, I have always a theory. When you read a book and then you watch the movie, as the author wasn't there when they were doing the movie to say, look, no, don't do this way. Oh, no, they say, put the table that way and this has to happen in that or in that way. It's like always you get, like, kind of, like, sometimes the director view of the story or how he wants to tell it. And as every person is different, if you have, I don't know, two directors of the same, probably same book, probably the movie won't be the same. So in this case, I like it more the book rather than the movie.
And myself, I like the book. I like the lessons that the book gives. I like
it
that.
It has a lot, actually.
And I also like that you have the differences of the sisters and the different personalities, and with the different personality that each one deals with something differently. And so I quite like that. The movie, I mean, it's a good movie. It's an enjoyable movie. It's a good Sunday afternoon, you know, sitting. It's raining outside.
Rainy day. I watch it on a rainy day.
With popcorn.
Yeah, you know, it's quite good for that. The only, my only criticism is it would have been nice to have the other sisters have a good look, good looking, because it does become like a Katharine Hepburn.
It would have been nice for a little more introspection on the sisters. It was the Katharine Hepburn show.
Yeah, and I kind of would like to have seen more of Joan Bennett. I love the aunt. I thought the aunt.
I would have loved to see more of Joan Bennett. I actually liked your performance as Amy. I really got a kick out of it because I'm so used to.
Yeah, I think everyone's really good in it. I just think that I just don't think that you got enough essence of the other characters to actually feel mm-hmm. anything for the other characters. I just felt like this is Joe's story. And now the thing is, I've never seen Little Women before. Anyway, I've never seen the other. The Winona Ryder one, or the 2019 one that came out, and I haven't seen the miniseries either. I'm not a fan of historical films. Anything
that's like got swashbuckling pirates and Errol Flynn and all that good
anything
stuff.
Anything that's got people in costume dress, I tend to stay away from.
We can't be friends anymore. Costume dress, we're horror aficionados. I mean, everybody's got costume dress.
I'm not really a fan of those, you know, the horror Hammer horrors or anything like that either. I've seen them, but I'm not a huge fan of those kind of things anyway. So, but I mean, I have watched them, and I do, you know, but I'm talking about generally speaking.
I tend to stay away from them.
It's a bit like if Pride and Prejudice is on. Like, I'm not watching that. They're in old fashioned clothing. I'm not watching costume drama.
I don't know when my sister used to watch this Little Women. I think it was a cartoon. I was really small at that time. I don't remember if there were maybe, I don't know, like 20 episodes or I don't know. But it was really interesting because it was kind of like, you know, the anime drawing of the story. And I don't remember much. I do remember there were like, I remember Joe and they were like, I remember how they were dressing. So when I was reading this, I could have an image, you know, like of the clothes, of how they could be dressed in that time. Mm. And yeah, and then I saw this movie. I haven't seen the other one with Winona Ryder and all the other ones. So I don't know.
So I really got nothing compared to. But I think overall, I think if you have a daughter out there and you want to read her a bedtime story, reading a chapter of this every night was a good way to go. I think
that's an excellent idea. That is a good idea for people listening. It is a good bedtime story.
Yes.
You know, you've got because each
episode is not. Yeah, it's not. Each chapter is not really, really long. So yeah, maybe I don't know, like in 10 minutes.
And it's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Each story is, isn't it? It's like
yes.
Yeah. Each one has their little adventure, and then by the end, the adventure ends, and then you move on to the next.
Followed by Jaws and The Exorcist.
Well, no, Alfonso, I have discovered in all this time that I have been reading here books with you, that books that are like short, like paragraphs like that, you know, like are easier to read because you can, for example, put it away and then you come back and then rather than when the story is really long, then you need something. I need personally to go and maybe, you know, one page and to catch up again and then carry on.
Mm. Yeah. It's an easy read. It was a very easy read. One of the easiest that we've had so far this season. So. Yeah. Well, that brings us to the end of Literary License Podcast and our coverage of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott in the 1933 film Little Women. Our next classic novels will be going down the drug-filled alleyway known as Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll and the 1954 Alice in Wonderland. And, of course, through our drug-filled month, we'll also be covering Ticked and Stung. So it's going to be a druggy month for everyone.
Yay, my favorite month.
Next week, we'll be covering Bewitched, Season 2, Episodes 1 through 4, and, of course, our double feature. Feature films are Attack of the 50-Foot Woman and The Incredible Shrinky Woman, two spectrums of womanhood. And of course, we'll be covering finishing up with Dark Shadows, and that will conclude this our month of June, which is the Women's Month. So that's why we're covering Little Women and the other films that we're covering. And as I said before, our next classic novels is Alice in Wonderland, the classic Lewis Carroll, and the 1954 Disney version as well. So it's good night for myself and good night, Vicky.
Good night, everybody. Stay safe.
Good night, Leandro.
Good night, everybody. Take care.
See you next week. We'll be Witch Season 2, Episodes 1 through 4. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. Ba, 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 ba. And don't tell me what to do.